All right, so tonight we're starting in Exodus chapter 2. Exodus chapter 2. So last week we talked about Abraham and the covenant that God made with Abraham, some of the promises God made to him. And quite a bit of time has passed since God's promise to Abraham. If you remember back then, what were some of the promises and agreements that God made with Abram, who later turned into Abraham? What did he tell him? Yes, so there's this land that they belong to and this big nation that was coming from him. Now the land, of course, was the land that Abraham was walking around. He didn't own it at the time, but God said that he would give it to him. And then there was the idea of a nation. God said that Abraham, from him, would be this great nation, which was miraculous. Why? Yeah, he hadn't had a child yet, and what else? There's lots of people who haven't had children yet, but what was the thing about Abraham? Yes, and I think he was of old, very old. Both of them were very old, so especially by the time their son Isaac came. So this was not just, hey, you'll have a family one day. Oh, great, I always hoped to anyway. No, it was, you're going to have a nation come from you, which was amazing to him because he and his wife had not been able to have children, and they were rapidly approaching or past the time that they were able to have children. So that was certainly an amazing promise to him. And then there's this idea that Dylan said of the seed. What does that mean? Perhaps the most amazing promise of all. Yeah. So not only would he have this great family, but through him, I guess you could assume that through his offspring, through whatever nation would come from him, all families of the earth would be blessed. So not only would Abraham be blessed, but through him there would be a way that everybody in the whole world would be blessed. So these were the promises to Abraham. And then we also talked about the covenant with Abraham. Anybody would like a copy of tonight's lesson? We have a few extra. Oh, good. I was really hoping Jared didn't waste the last 3 minutes of his life. So then there was a covenant with Abraham. Remember, Abraham got these promises from God, but the big problem, well, not the big problem, but the concern of his was, okay, I know the promises, how is this going to happen? Again, he had been in the promised land, things were not going particularly smoothly, there were all kinds of obstacles he was facing. On top of that, there still was no child. He had a growing household, but the household wasn't his, it was servants, things like that. It wasn't his biological offspring. So he kind of asked God, what's going on? How am I supposed to know? How is this going to be fulfilled? And God's response, of course, is to take him outside and tell him to look at what? The stars. And his response is, just like you see all those up there, that's what your children are going to be like. And that great verse, Abraham at that point believed God, and that was righteousness on his part. So God considered Abraham to be righteous because of his faith and his belief in God. And then there's this whole scene where there's kind of a covenant that God makes with Abraham. Abraham falls into this deep sleep, and God tells him of the future and says, you will have this family, but know that for 400 years they will be in not so great a situation. They will be serving another nation, but never fear, I will bring them out of that servitude and then bring them back to this land when the time is right. And so that is where we left off last time. And so now we're going forward a little bit in time. In fact, about 400 years in time and a little more than that. And here is Moses and talk of the Exodus. So In chapter 2 of Exodus, could somebody please read verses 23 to the end of the chapter.
During those many days, the king of Egypt died, and the people of Israel groaned because of their slavery and cried out for help. Their cry for rescue from slavery came to God, and God heard their groaning, and God remembered his covenant with Abraham, with Isaac, and with Jacob. God saw the people of Israel, and God knew.
Great, thanks. So some time has passed, some significant time. Abraham's family's grown. They've gone down to Egypt for a while. Joseph, right, he was definitely one of the most popular guys in Egypt. Everybody really liked him. Pharaoh, because of Joseph's deliverance of Egypt, gave Joseph's family some nice land. But eventually, Egypt didn't look too kindly on the children of Abraham and decided to turn them into slaves, so thinking that that would keep them from causing any problems. So they've been there in slavery for a long time. And then we have these verses. What do you think about these verses that Orvet just read for us? There's a lot in here, just these three verses here. Okay, so certainly the people of Israel are groaning. Life is not good. Yeah.
Well, with that, I mean, it seems like the Israelites, I mean, because I really picked up on that too, is the groaning, that God heard the groans and he acted upon that. And later on, what will the Israelites do again? They'll keep groaning and saying this and that and the other, and then it turns towards God about this groaning. So it's just, I thought it was just kind of fascinating that this is what's being used here, and then a God response, and then for future study, you know, how does he respond to groaning then?
Right. What's the maybe attitude behind it? Yeah, interesting thoughts. Yeah.
Kind of what I got from it, kind of a little bit of a lesson is, you know, even today, you know, when we're suffering and, you know, we ask God to help us all, even though they were slavery a long time, but God eventually did hear their groaning and their suffering, and he did help them. So that, you know, we need to remember that eventually God is going to help, or, you know, he's going to do what we need or take care of us.
Yeah, definitely. What else? Anything else that jumps out to anybody?
Remembered?
Yeah, God remembered what?
Well, he remembered his promise. I mean, it's just like we studied last week where he said, you know, your people will be in captivity for 400 years and then inherit the land.
Mm-hmm.
So this is the time.
Right.
Because I imagine they, you know, like we said, groaned, you know, 300 years. I mean, because these are different generations that are going through. So.
Okay. Yeah, the time is here. I think a couple hands. Dylan, do you have your hand up?
I think it's worth noting verse 25. When God saw the sons of Israel, God took notice of them. Clearly communicating, God's looking down, has a view, in this case, of the Israelites, but just some real clear application of that to us, a variety of these verses. But, I mean, we are visible to him, he's attentive, he's paying attention, he sees.
Yeah.
He takes notes.
Definitely. I think there's a hand over. Gary, do you have your hand up?
It's more of a question. It's interesting in verse 24, the one where you were talking about, he remembered, God remembered. God forget things.
Well, let me ask you, what do you think that verse is saying?
Moses is an inspired writer, and Moses is recording this. To me, it is, again, a man writing his interpretation. If you were to go away for a while and you came back, you would say, well, do you think Andrew's going to remember me? Yeah, he's going to remember you because you're here.
He agrees with you, in fact. Yeah.
it's interesting. Moses is attributing, and I'll call it human traits, you know, the idea of remembering to God.
Okay.
I don't think he forgot. I don't think it was out of his mind or any of that.
It just perhaps now is the moment that
the time is fulfilled.
Yeah, for for that to come about, the promise that was made. And God has not forgotten about that, I guess you could say. Yeah.
One of the things I picked up out of this gentleman was that it's because of the bondage of the suffering, the groaning that they cried out. It's almost as if it's setting a precedent of, it seems like the only time the Israelites turn to God is in their suffering. Mm-hmm. You wonder, you know, is that the only time that they look to God? Going on before that, how did they lose that blessing? Sure. You know, things like that. But I think you can get that into another question. But, you know, is that the only time that we turn to God is in our groaning, in our suffering?
Mm-hmm.
And that's, you know,
that's
something.
Yeah, definitely. These verses, there's a lot in here. These are great points people are bringing out. I wanted to capture this here, though, because you know, there's a lot about the story of Moses and early Exodus, you know, being put in the river and things like that, and which is all great. But for our purposes, as we're tracing kind of the story of redemption as it's going through, I really like these verses because it shows that God has not forgotten, right? I mean, everything that has happened since Abraham, hundreds of years prior, doesn't mean that suddenly God either forgot, or he's not powerful enough to keep things in control, or he's somehow surprised, you know, oh no, that Abraham's children, you know, end up in a jam. You know, that's not what's going on here. Rather, it's history, as God said, it has come about, and God realizes where the people are, and God knows. And what an amazing conclusion to verse 25. God sees the people, and God knows. And I think that is true from the beginning of this story of redemption to the end, that God knows exactly what is going on. He knows where it fits in with his purposes, and he knows what he's going to do. So what great comfort for us. And I asked in verse 2, could this describe God's relationship with anybody today? Or in question 2, could this description of these few verses, and there's probably a lot of different ways that maybe people thought to apply this, but and some people have already hinted at this, but any thoughts for people today? Or maybe in other times other than the Exodus? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. He will fulfill those, and he does not forget what he said.
No matter how long, perhaps, it seems like it's been. Yeah, it's a great point. Other thoughts? Yeah.
I thought about Christians in other countries who are severely persecuted for their faith.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we don't face that right now here. I mean, we face persecution in different ways, but I think about people in other countries who have to do it in hiding and who are executed for their faith. And I think they must surely be crying out to God.
Right. And what an amazing thing to think that, again, this is not out of God's control. It's not like he is helplessly watching these things happen. But God knows. Right now, however this all fits in with his purposes, maybe we don't know, but God knows what's going on. And what an amazing thought. You know, you think in our lives, even if it's maybe it's not as severe, but when difficult things happen to us, we cry out to God, God sees, and God knows. Yeah, Rob.
Yeah, to that point, again, this is all those that call upon the name of the Lord shall be saved. And in the order in James, he says, you know, draw near to him, he will draw near to you. So that relationship is there for us today. But we have to draw near to him. We have to call upon him.
Mm-hmm.
He sees us. He remembers us. He acknowledges us. But he wants that same thing.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, so those verses there kind of show what's going on, big picture, from God's perspective. The time has come, and God knows what's happening. So then we get into chapter 3, and chapter 3 talks about what happens next. And who does God talk to next? So God remembers his covenant. Who's he talk to? Moses. Yeah. So he talks to Moses, and of course, chapter 3 is the very memorable story of the burning bush. We're not going to take the time to read through the chapter just because it's fairly long, but could somebody kind of summarize that chapter? What's the gist of what God is saying here to Moses? Yeah, Bonnie. I don't know if that was a hand or a stretch, but we'll consider it a hand and you're stuck.
Well, first he made it clear who Moses was talking to and who he was as far as the family goes, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and that he is aware of what's going on with the children of Israel. He's heard that. And that he has a plan for bringing them out and bringing them to the land. And Moses is a part of that plan. And then Moses starts to protest. And this is... the rest of it is God overcoming his protestations.
Yeah, yeah, well said. Definitely. Anything else from that chapter?
Holy ground.
Okay, yeah, so perhaps this appreciation, maybe when Moses is first understanding who he's talking to, of God's holiness and the importance of respecting that. Yeah.
My thought is the change in Moses at this point, because after he's been in the wilderness for 40 years, and when he left Egypt, he had just killed an Egyptian. He was prince of Egypt, and probably had a certain amount of entitlement and that sort of feeling of, I don't know if it felt elite or whatever, but he had a certain level of self-esteem about him. Mm-hmm. And here we find him, and when God tells him that he's going to be the one that delivers the people out of Egypt, he questions that. So you can see that he's a lot more humble man now. And it just shows the condition that Moses is in, that he's been humbled by his time. And I think it's interesting. I think we give some of these characters in the Old Testament a hard time for questioning God using them. But it seems like God uses these people that have been humbled or are humbled to begin with. Mm-hmm. It shows kind of the importance of that.
Yeah, that's a great point. Like Rob said, of people drawing near to God or, you know, humbling themselves, and then and we know certainly that humility is what God is looking for. I think it would be rare, if ever, in the Old Testament you find one of these men or women that God uses in a big way, in a good way, I should say, because there are certain people that are bad that he uses in big ways, but in a kind of a big, good way, that when God shows up, they say, "Glad you're here, God. I knew you were going to call me one day because I'm your man," right, or your woman. It's generally, that's less of the attitude, and it's more of, who am I for this kind of thing. I think, Rob, did you have your hand up? And Alex. Okay, yeah, Alex.
I have a question. Why a burning bush? Why would God now talk to Moses via this way, whereas when he talked to Noah and Abraham, it was more direct? Here he has to put on, you know, for lack of a better term, he is putting on a disguise. So why the burning bush?
Or why this method? That's a great question. What do you think? Gary has the answer, definitive answer.
An interesting observation, because it ends up in the book of Acts, the seventh chapter. Stephen is talking to the Jews there, but he reaccounts the history. And in chapter 7 and starting in verse 30, and it says, "After 40 years had passed, an angel appeared to him in the wilderness of the mount, in the flame of a burning thorn bush. And then Moses saw it and began to marvel at the sight. And as he approached to look more closely, there came a voice of the Lord, 'I am the God.'" So at first, there's an angel, again, a messenger, somebody working for God who's in the bush. And Moses is attracted to it. I'm guessing that any of us, if we were out in the woods and there was a glowing bush, we'd probably go up and kind of take a look at it.
Okay. Other thoughts? Yeah, Jared.
I think that the answer to the question is because God chose to. And what's more important is what God didn't do then. In Hebrews, it talks about this, the way that God used to speak to people. That's how Hebrews begins. Hebrews 1, verse 1. God, after he spoke long ago to the fathers and the prophets in many portions and in many ways, and these last days has spoken to us in his Son. So God was going to pick a whole bunch of different ways to speak to people, but he was pointing towards there's going to be a better way, more direct way later on, which goes back to our scheme of redemption.
Yeah, great point. And, you know, we kind of jokingly said that Gary would have the answer just because he raised his hand. But, yeah, we don't, you know exactly why this is and stuff like that. But certainly, what a great contrast you think of Jesus here as both God and man at the same time that could physically touch people, talk with people, walk around. How much greater the appearance of God has been now for us than it was back then. But Alice, interesting observation that how we've seen God talking with the prior people. He made a little bit different form here. Of course, he talks to Moses in all kinds of ways throughout his life, and perhaps in ways with Moses that are more intimate than maybe he did with Abraham. So why the burning bush and the angel of the Lord being in the burning bush and what all that means, I don't know. But that's a great question. There's one other interesting thing, I think, about chapter 3, besides all the great stuff people have summarized in there, is toward the end, what does God tell Moses ahead of time toward the end of chapter 3 about Pharaoh, the king of Egypt? So can somebody just read verses 19 through the end of the chapter, please.
But I am sure that the king of Egypt will not let you go, no, not even by a mighty hand. So I will stretch my hand out and strike Egypt with all my wonders, which I will do in its midst. And after that he will let you go. And I will give this kingdom favor in the sight of the Egyptians, and it shall be when you go that you shall not go empty-handed. But every woman shall ask of her neighbor, namely of her who dwells near her house, articles of silver, articles of gold, and clothing, and you shall put them on your sons and on your daughters. So you shall come to the Egyptians.
Thank you. So what does God say about the king of Egypt, the Egyptians? What is Moses walking into here?
They're going to get to plunder them.
Well, certainly they're going to get to plunder them, right? Before that, though, what's going to be the reaction? Yeah, certainly God is well aware that Pharaoh is not going to be in agreement with this plan. The plan he said earlier, go tell him, hey, we need to go in 3 days' journey in the wilderness so we can sacrifice to God. But God says, I know when you tell Pharaoh that he is not going to willingly let you do that. And so God is going to have to stretch out his hand and strike Egypt until they let them go. And then, like Patricia said, at that point, they'll plunder the Egyptians. Think of that. God saying ahead of time, you are going to take all kinds of goods from the Egyptians before you leave. And he talks about just asking your neighbor. Can you imagine your neighbor trying to get rid of you and you saying, well, before I go, any watches? You know, like, yes, take my Rolex. Well, any earrings? You know, yeah, take them. What about cash? You know, and then they're just giving, you know, what about your china? And they're saying, yeah, take it. That's what's going on here. Patricia, and then, yeah.
It kind of reminds me of our families trying to get us to fall away, not letting us go to worship and stuff.
Yeah, that there could be opposition today, just as there was opposition back then. Yeah, Gary.
What I find interesting is God didn't tell him everything. Part of the reason why the Egyptians were going to give him all this stuff is guess what just happened? You lost your firstborn of everything. Mm-hmm. Wouldn't you be giving people, take it and go,
right,
get out of here? I don't want to see you.
Right. And I think it's the reason I wanted to emphasize this is just to remind myself and us that God knows the end. And this is not a surprise to him. And I think sometimes it's easy to forget that, I think, when we are in the details of the difficulties of our lives. Because certainly it was a challenge for Moses, the Exodus period. I don't think it was easy, right, to walk into Pharaoh that first time. But of course, God knows what's happening. And it is not like, I mean, this is not like Indiana Jones. I don't know if you guys remember, not the new Indiana Jones movie, but I think The Last Crusade, at one point someone asked Indiana Jones, well, what are you doing next? And his response is, I don't know, I'm kind of making this up as I go along, right? Because that was Indiana Jones's approach toward life. And, you know, and that makes sense. We all kind of make this up as we go along because we can't tell the future. We don't know what's happening. We're trying to just make do with what we have. That's not God. God is not making this up as he goes along in the sense that, oh no, Pharaoh said no, what do I do next? I mean, that is just horrible even to think about. God knows what's going to happen. He's telling Moses what part Moses needs to play and letting him know the end. And it's the same thing with us, right? I mean, he tells us what part he expects us to play, but we know the end of the story. And it's just as guaranteed our end of the story as it was Moses. I think there's a hand.
I think that sometimes people, especially skeptical people, have a view of God that he is sort of absentee and mankind is a hobby. Mm-hmm. He kind of comes back to you every now and then and say, hey, I wonder how men are doing. Well, I'll go find out. Oh, whoa, things are bad. I should do something. And you can see throughout this story, throughout this narrative, that he's saying, I know what's going to happen. I know how it's going to happen, and I'm going to be the one to get it there. His involvement is at every step.
Yeah, and certainly, and all this is going to happen because he cares about his people, and he's honoring his promises to his glory and stuff like that. Great, we're going to move on now to chapter 12, just because we have two big topics to cover tonight. So that was kind of the time of the Exodus has arrived, and we basically saw God's paying attention. He has not forgotten his promises. He knows the whole picture. He's providing a way for his people to come through this, and he gives Moses a part to play in all of this. Then we get to chapter 12. So Moses goes to Pharaoh. We have all the plagues, right? Pharaoh's not interested in letting the people go. Again, God said, I would strike Egypt until they would let the people go. So consider Egypt struck, right? We have the plagues that are coming. The final plague, of course, people have alluded to it, is the death of the firstborn. That was kind of previewed. And then we have this idea of the Passover. Now God talks to his people. Not now, like this is the first time, but maybe switching from the idea of talking to Pharaoh and saying, here's a plague that's coming. Now Moses and Aaron are to give instruction to the children of Israel. So let's take a look at chapter 12. And could somebody read verses 1 through 13, please? Just kind of give us an idea of what this is about.
Now the Lord said to Moses and Aaron in the land of Egypt, this month shall be the beginning of months for you. It is to be the first month of the year to you. Speak to all the congregation of Israel, saying, on the 10th of this month, they are each one to take a lamb for themselves, according to their father's households, a lamb for each household. Now if the household is too small for a lamb, then he and his neighbor nearest to his house are to take one according to the number of persons in them, according to what each man should eat. You are to divide the lamb. Your lamb shall be an unblemished male, a year old. You may take it from the sheep or from the goats. You shall take it until the 14th day of the same month. Then the whole assembly of the congregation of Israel is to kill it at twilight. Moreover, they shall take some of the blood and put it on the two doorposts and on the lintel of the houses in which they eat it. They shall eat the flesh that same night, roasted with fire, and they shall eat it with unleavened bread and bitter herbs. Do not eat any of it raw or boiled at all with water, but rather roasted with fire, both its head and its legs, along with its entrails. And you shall not leave any of it over until morning, but whatever is left of it until morning, you shall burn with fire. Now you shall eat it in this manner, with your loins girded, your sandals on your feet, and your staff in your hand. And you shall eat it in the haste. It is the Lord's Passover. For I will go through the land of Egypt on that night, and will strike down all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, both men and beast. And against all the gods of Egypt I will execute judgments. I am the Lord. The blood shall be a sign for you on the houses where you lived. And when I see the blood, I will pass over you. And no plague will befall you to destroy you when I strike the land of Egypt.
Thank you. Okay, so in this section of scripture here, we learn about this observance called the Passover. Why is this called the Passover? Okay. And Passover, and maybe we'll talk in more detail about what he was doing, right, and exactly what was being passed over and stuff like that. Any other thoughts? Any wordsmiths out there that love this kind of thing? And if not, that's fine too. Okay, well, so I think it's very simple, at least it's my understanding is the verb, and of course Passover is our term for this, but the verb that of what God was doing is turned into the name of this observance. So the idea of God passing over or being over something, then we say, well, we think of that, then our term would be the Passover. But in the original language is the same thing. The word describing this observance was from the verb of what God was doing. So what exactly was God doing? Alex said he was passing over Egypt. Who or what was he passing over and why?
It wasn't so much passing over Egypt as he was going through it, and he was bringing upon judgment that he just told them, I'm going to do. Mm-hmm. All the firstborn of animals and of your people. The passing over is in regards to when he came to a house that had the proper blood on it, he skipped that house.
Right. So he's going through Egypt. There are certain homes that have been marked. God passes over them. He does not strike dead the people in that home, and he moves on to the next house. Again, the plague was the firstborn of, every firstborn in Egypt would die in one night, if you could imagine every firstborn dying in one night in Colorado Springs. Like if we all wake up in the morning and, every animal, right, every child, everything that was born first had died at once. What a horrible thing. But not everyone, because in certain places God would pass over, and he would pass over what? Jared mentioned this marking. What is this, the marking? The blood, right? So he would pass over the blood. And I wanted to talk about this. Again, we're talking about redemption and God's plan for our redemption. There certainly are many, many holidays and feasts that God created for the Jews. But I wanted to focus on this one in particular because I feel like there's a lot of really rich symbolism here for us and when we think of the story of redemption and God's eternal plans. So what do y'all think? What might the events of the Passover, the details, what might these things symbolize? Yeah, we got a lamb, they roast it, right? So they put some blood on the door. What do you think?
I'm not really sure, but I think the blood of the lamb would be, because God passed over them and saved them, Jesus Christ, that the blood of the lamb is what's going to save us. So.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. So let's think about that a little bit more. The idea of this blood of the lamb, right? So they take blood, they put it on the doorposts. Let's make the connection a little bit more with us. I mean, what is this about for us? Yeah.
We know that Jesus, the Lamb of God, he was the Lamb that was sent for us through the shedding of his blood. So in a sense, that his blood symbolizes that blood that saved the firstborn. It's his blood that saves us.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. Yeah. What were we going to say?
It took a sacrifice of a lamb or a kid in order to save
Yeah, and in the same way as all these people have talked about, we are saved, right, because of the blood of Christ. You think about the coming destruction and what God was doing to Egypt, what will happen to all, right, at some point in the future. The destruction is coming. The judgment is coming, but there will be people that God will pass over, so to speak. And I'm not saying it's going to look exactly like what happened in Exodus, but I think the comparison is such that when that comes, there will be some that will not have to fear that judgment because they are identified by the blood. And of course, that would be the blood of Christ. They're clothed in the blood of Christ, and therefore, God will pass over, in a sense, when bringing judgment. Yes?
You know, before that lamb was even slaughtered, it talks about the choosing of the lamb and how it had to be without blemish. And I think that's an obvious connection to Christ and him being blameless. That was the first one that stuck out to me as far as the symbolism.
Yeah, definitely. It shows that, again, one of these pictures of the sacrifice or the center of this meal, of this festival, this is going to be something that is pure. Any other thoughts about the feast, the symbolism there, things we could think about? Yeah. Okay, so let's talk. So talk about that a little bit more. How do you think there's some connection there, or?
I think that there is, because again, where was Jesus when he instituted the Lord's Supper, and what was he doing? He was doing this,
mm-hmm.
And it ends up. It's one of those things you look at and say, why these symbols or emblems were used. Because they were used, the Jews understood, they were emblematic, maybe not so much on the fruit of the vine side, but when Jesus said it, he said, this is my blood.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it's interesting to think of course, we're going to get into a lot of this next week when we talk about the Red Sea, but you have the children of Israel, they are in slavery, and this is the night that they are freed from that slavery. And you think about us in the slavery of sin that we were in, and we are freed from that slavery because of what Jesus did for us. So there's some interesting parallels there. And a lot of that we'll get into next week. Okay, any other thoughts? I don't have any particular answers I'm looking for. It's just things that people notice. Yeah.
You've been asking us to think of pictures of redemption. And I assume that this is one of the reasons you picked this, because this is not the Passover, a picture of just that. Another thought, another picture, another story of how God has redeemed us throughout the beginning, from the beginning.
Yeah, definitely. Now, let's go back to, Gary mentioned the unleavened bread. What was one of the reasons why it was unleavened?
Haste,
yeah. What's that mean?
They couldn't wait for it to rise.
Yeah, right? And how were they supposed to eat this?
They were ready to go.
Ready to go, right? Like, you know, sometimes we eat, right? You only have a few minutes, and you're like, we have to eat this now, and then get out of here. So they were eating ready to go. In fact, they didn't have leaven. There was no time for this bread to leaven, things like that. Something I thought about that is, it's interesting. They were there, the Jews. They didn't belong in Egypt. God was coming. And they needed to be ready to get out of there. And God was emphasizing, you don't belong here. You need to be ready to go. Is there any parallels with us about that? If so, what? Or if not, why not? Yeah, what do you think?
Same thing. We have to study. We have to be ready because we don't know when God's coming. And if we're not ready, then we're not going to be able to make it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. Yeah, Jared.
The leaven is really an interesting aspect. We tend to focus more on the fruit of the vine, the blood side. But it comes to mean this idea of purity, this idea of removing ourselves from the presence of. So there is this part of it, you know, where we're on a journey. We think about the song, "This World Is Not Our Home." We're headed someplace. Mm-hmm. Certainly that is an aspect that goes along with it. But the only place in the New Testament that I'm aware of that clearly says Christ is our Passover is 1 Corinthians 5, and it's talking about the leaven. And it's in the context of you have a sinful person in their midst, and he's saying we should not allow that. We should not allow that sort of wickedness in our presence. And so 1 Corinthians 5, verses 7 and 8, he's emphasizing the purity that we're to have. It says, clean out the old leaven so that you may be a new lump, just as you are, in fact, unleavened. For Christ, our Passover also has been sacrificed. Therefore, let us celebrate the feast not with old leaven, nor with the leaven of malice and wickedness, but with the unleavened bread of sincerity and truth.
Yeah. Great points. So we think about this idea of purity, you know, and what, how we are supposed to be behaving now. And you can even connect that with the idea of haste, because we don't belong here, right? So instead of clinging to the things here, we are cleaning the evil out of our lives, and we are focused forward on what is right. And certainly we need to keep that purity to be pleasing to God. So there's so much here that is just so amazing to think about. And you just wonder, those original people who ate that first Passover, I mean, what they thought of it, and had no idea, I mean, thousands of years later, just what the real, the complete picture of the Passover would look like of Jesus coming. Has anybody ever seen a Passover meal or like watched one happen or sat down?
I'd love to.
It's kind of interesting. Is that like 1 minute left? Or okay. Oh, that was the last. Okay, I got this, and I didn't know if that was 2 minutes or 2 seconds. Oh, okay, that was second bell. Okay, well, I remember one time in school in D.C., we had a lot of Jewish folks, and they'd set up a Passover. I didn't watch all of it, but I was there just kind of to see. It was really an interesting type of thing that I always think of when I think of this chapter. Okay, so the end of chapter 12, didn't have time to get to, but basically, they leave Egypt just as God promised. They plunder Egypt. What great victory. And when does this take place? Writer says Moses, 430 years. They've been in Egypt just as promised to Abraham. There's this period of time that they would be there, and then God would bring them out. So what a great thing. Verse 42, I really like, talks about God was watching them. And so that night then is observed by the Jewish people as watching as a watch kept to the Lord. And what a great thing that is. Okay, next week, lessons are in the back. We're going to talk about an even bigger picture of redemption here, and that is the flood. Thanks a lot. Or not the flood, the Red Sea. Thanks a lot.